So I'm in Amherst, which is in...
You're in Northampton.
Northampton, in Western Massachusetts. I'm not sure where I am. And do you want to introduce yourself?
Okay, my name is Anna Marie Russo. I live in Northampton. I've lived here for 18 years.
Do you want to tell us a bit about this area? It's a relatively rural area, not a big city, I suppose.
This isn't a big city. There's about 28,000 here. This college, Smith College, has about 5,000 students, I think it is. This area is a lot of small towns, agricultural, rural, and old history going back for abolition work. During the revolutionary period here, colonial period, Shays Rebellion was located, that group was located here. So resistance to authority is definitely ingrained in the area.
You joined NEFAC recently.
I did join NEFAC
recently.
Which
is interesting because, I mean, I know a fair few older anarchists, but they're generally people who've been part of the movement for many years. It's quite unusual to have somebody who's older coming into it. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, it's a challenge coming in as an older person because I don't really have this background that a lot of the older people I know have had, you know, working in, you know, they were part of the student movements in the 60s or 70s while I was working as a bartender in those days, just trying to raise my son, single parent sort of thing. Not that I didn't have sympathies, I just wasn't a joiner. Mm. I just didn't understand it. And, okay, so my son was born in 1971, and one of the songs that caught my attention then, I was working in a shop. I lived in Key West, Florida, and I was working in a shop selling jeans and T-shirts. And the song that captured my imagination, for some reason, was Teach Your Children Well, Crosby, Stills, and Nash. And so teach your children well, blah, 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 blah. And then it goes, children, teach your parents well. And, you know, for some reason it stuck in my brain. We went on in life, my son and I. I took him to college 1 year. He took me to college the next year. I had an opportunity to get a college degree, something I wanted for a long time. Don't ask me why. Now I couldn't tell you. No, I can tell you, but I mean, it wasn't what I thought it would be. I'm the first one in my family to graduate from college. My son didn't graduate from college. I did. And so while I was in college, my son was still in school, but he had gone over to Europe, and he had gotten involved. He had already been involved in starting with sort of Amnesty International and Greenpeace petition signatures. Then he went to Europe. He really got involved in stuff. For 2 years he was there, and I was a student here, a college student, and I was in a women's college, and Smith is a women's college. So I'm with women who are my son's age. It was really great because it was hard for me to go to school. I didn't have a great academic background, so I had to struggle a lot. And some of these students, younger women, came from, you know, great academic backgrounds, very smart and so on. I really had to struggle. And then my son had forced me to learn email before he left because he was in a college and I was. It was a way we could communicate without it costing us any money, which we wouldn't have been able to afford. And so he's writing to me about he was in formerly East Germany. He had gotten together with some comrades. They were in a squat. He wrote me all these tales of things that were happening, attacked by a group of neo-Nazi skinheads, their social club. They wanted to come in, and they had big sticks or something. And I thought, what the heck is he doing? How's he going to get a job? How's he going to support himself? What, am I going to be able to support him the rest of my life? I can't do that. But, you know, at the same time, because he's my only child and I'm the only parent, I didn't want to lose track, and so I started studying. I studied actually with Martha Acklesberg, who wrote a book called Free Women of Spain.
Ah, nice.
So I studied a course with her called Urban Social Movements, I think it was called, and then she also had a seminar. I took the seminar. By that time, my son had returned from Europe, and then he told me how he had gotten all his clothes diving in a dumpster. I thought, oh, my God, what's he doing? And he goes out to Berkeley. So my first winter break after he got back, I went out to Berkeley. I stayed in a squat with him and some of his comrades, and I wrote a paper for my urban social because I thought, this is so interesting. I had heard Angela Davis speak at UMass. A student had asked her, you know, so how did you organize this social, you know, your movement back then in the 60s? And Angela Davis saying, well, you know, we didn't really know exactly what we were doing at the time. It's only now, looking back, you can see that, you know, this happened and that happened, and you can tell a story, a narrative, but, you know, then we were just doing it. You can't always tell what's going on when you're in it. And that's stuck in my head. And so out in Berkeley, one of the reasons I wanted to do it, because these emails I'd gotten from my son and describing things that were happening, all over the world, all over Europe and in Eastern Europe and going into Kyrgyzstan and all these places I wasn't even sure how to spell. It seemed like there was something happening. This was before Seattle, 99. This was in the early and mid-90s. So I thought, let me try to write about this, you know, in the sense of Angela Davis saying, you can't really describe it. So I went out to Berkeley, and I wasn't sure what I was looking at. I was staying in a squat. I made a list of all the things I had never heard of, like Cop Watch and Food Not Bombs and Homes Not Jails. These were all little movements that I saw in the 10 days that I was out there. But the main thing I focused on then was the Food Not Bombs, partly because Food Not Bombs was served in People's Park, which had this history going back to the 1960s. And when I was there, which I think was 1993, there was a move afoot by the university to retake People's Park. And they had put up a volleyball court as a sort of a encroachment. So it was causing some controversy. So, yeah, it was interesting to write about this and to learn a little bit about what my son was involved in, and it opened my mind to thinking about movements, and so eventually I got involved with NEFAC because my son was involved, I guess. But this notion of anarchist-communist, like at first I thought, well, what the heck is that? I like the fact that it's focused on people who work, on workplace issues, on housing issues, because these are the struggles I know from my own life. I just wasn't involved in a movement, or I didn't understand that I was part. I could have been part of a movement. So in a way, it's connected to my life, and it's connected to my son's life, and it's more political than I've been in my past. I think that's how I see it. What I can do with that out here, I'm not sure, besides my own understanding. It was great being able to bring you out here, and that's partly because, you know, I've had these ongoing discussions with the Matthew from the Food for Thought book collective, Workers' Own Collective, that he opened the space and was willing to do it there. And I've had these conversations about anarchism for the last 10 years with him, that we can have other events, that there's a future in this to keep this conversation going. It's very exciting that you've brought here this story about what was happening in Ireland. I like that you framed it in tales, anecdotes, that you relate it to theory, political ideas, that they also link to, like, the Sabatistas. I really am captured by this idea that it's not that the revolution will happen, but that it is right now, and that we're part of it, and how to make that real and visible.
So we had the meeting last night at the bookstore in Amherst. Mm-hmm. One of the interesting things I found was that there's, you know, quite a bit of political activity going on in the area, particularly in terms of the local anti-war group. Do you want to tell us about what they do?
Yeah, so in Northampton, there's a group, the Northampton Committee Against the War in Iraq, which used to be the Northampton Committee Against Sanctions. So it started 9 years ago. And when somebody found out about the depleted uranium and this effect on children and the cancer rate in Iraq, so people started vigiling, and the people who founded it were primarily Francis Crowe, who this year will be turning 89, I believe it is, who's been an anti-war activist since the 1940s, and very active, arrested many times, worked with Plowshares, Daniel Berrigan brothers, the Berrigan brothers and so on, Catholic workers stuff, friends, Quakers, and Claudia Lefko, who has the Iraqi Children's Art Exchange, goes to Iraq and now Amman, working with children there to do artwork, and then works with children here to do artwork so that these generations of children get to know each other outside of this mainstream rhetoric about terrorists. But the tradition of anti-war activism is very strong in this area. Amherst has had an ongoing vigil for over 20 years, I think, on the town common every week. The Northampton Committee has a vigil every Saturday, and then we have a free film on Fridays, which is about anti-war, but also about other things. Alternative ways to think about creating a healthcare system, something like Cuba, for example. What else? A lot of things. A lot of different things. Water, immigration. Not a lot on workers' stuff. Most of the people in the anti-war movement are already retired.
So I discovered this morning that Northampton has a bit of anarchist history connected to it, which is in connection with the Haymarket martyrs, the trade union organizers executed in Chicago, which mm-hmm. May Day around the world commemorates. Mm-hmm. not so much in North America, of course, but in Europe, there's big labor marches on May Day. Do you want to tell us about the guy?
Yeah, his name is Dyer Lum. He was a Civil War veteran. He was a writer. I think he was a journalist. And he heard about the Haymarket affair, and then he goes to the arrests, and then he goes to Chicago. I can't recall if he knew the people at first. He was very active in the labor movement. And so he goes to Chicago, and he actually writes a pamphlet about it. I think it was the first thing that had been written about it. He was a lover of Voltairine de Cleyre, another American anarchist. His family came from this area. At some point along the way, he just became despondent, depressed. He was living in Brooklyn then, in New York, I guess, in Brooklyn, I can't think. And he was found dead, but he's buried here in Northampton. It doesn't say anything on his gravestone about him being an anarchist, but since we found out about it, we're doing a commemoration there on May Day. Last year we did it. We'll probably do it again this year. We gathered about 20 people, put red carnations on the grave, and said what we knew about him.
And then one of the things he's connected with is one of the martyrs, Louis Ling, cheated the executioner by killing himself in his cell the night before. And it's thought this person brought in the means of doing so.
Yes, that's what Paul Averich wrote in one of his books. And it was a story that Paul Averich heard and put together.
So one of the things I'm doing as I interview people going around is in Ireland, the big story for the last few months and for the next X months is going to be the US elections,
yeah.
The primaries, how people are doing in that. What's your take on the whole thing?
Oh, just too much money spent on it, basically. I don't even know what the figures are, maybe hundreds of millions of dollars, I'm not sure. It's a crime. I don't have a preference as far as that goes for one or the other of the main candidates or any of the main candidates. I was a supporter of Kucinich, partly because as a child, he and his family had to live in a station wagon, and he sort of brings that, he doesn't talk about that all the time, but that knowledge is, I somehow hear it when he speaks, the sorts of things that he campaigns for. But then he dropped out of the race, and he's a representative, he's in the House of Representatives from Cleveland, Ohio. And the Republicans are rallying a lot, and the Democrats as well, candidates for his seat. He's coming up for re-election this year. So he dropped out of the presidential race, small amount of money. He was being squeezed out of the debates. But, he had some interesting ideas, Department of Peace, his health care ideas, get out of Iraq. He put forward proposals to not fund any more of the war, just to fund the troops coming home. And these things all got defeated. But, in general, the idea of the presidential election is about a lot of money, corporations and influence and jockeying for positions. It's a big distraction, it seems. It's a big distraction. Nobody talks about the war much, not just about the war, but the people whose lives are being destroyed by it in Iraq and the rest of the Middle East and here in the States. There's a family who doesn't live in Belchertown. It's about a 40-minute drive from here. Son came home from service, from combat. He seemed fine, except he was drinking a lot. He didn't seem unusual. I mean, they thought that his friends and family thought that maybe he was acting a little unusual, but they couldn't put their finger on it. He had gone to see a psychiatrist, I guess, but his father found him hanging in the... He hung himself in the basement of the house one day. So it was a huge tragedy in that family. And this rate of suicides in returning Iraq vets is rising. We have a local fellow named Tyler Boudreau, a Marine for 12 years, did combat in Iraq. He was an infantry commander or something like this. I heard him speak a couple weeks ago. And, he really, in his anecdotes, you get the sense that you're there. You're a soldier. You've been trained to do this, kill, to defend yourself and the people that you're with. You don't know who the enemy is. You can't tell combatants from civilians. You're in dangerous situations in a place where people don't want you to be. And you're not sure what you're doing there. He had a bunch of stories that he wasn't just talking abstractly. He was talking about, one anecdote. I don't know if you want to keep this. But they were bivouacked out in the desert somewhere. There were a lot of rats would come crawling over them while they were sleeping, would be eating their food, very bold. And he said one night he put these sticky notes around his bunk, and he caught a rat got stuck, Tyler wakes up, grabs his knife, and plunges it into the rat. And he feels this moment of conscience of, what have I done? And then he thinks, immediately thinks, wait a minute, I'm infantry. I'm trained to kill human beings, and I'm having a qualm about killing a rat. So in some way, this reality about killing, what he was doing there, was dramatic for him. Later on, he told a story about being in South Carolina, sitting at a bar, and next to him is sitting this old dude, like Second World War, a Korean War vet. They start talking. Tyler starts telling him some of his tales. This whole thing about, there was a story about some Marines shooting into a car, thinking they were insurgents, and it turns out it was like a mother, father, and child. The terrible weight of that. And this old guy says, screw him. And Tyler said, and you know, I knew what he meant, because it's your life or the other person's life. You don't know in that moment. And then he ended his talk by saying, talking a little bit about how people are being put in this situation to make these horrendous decisions in the moment because their life depends on it. But they're being sent there by forces that are not reputable. You know, they're totally questionable. And he said, if it's true that there are forces of evil out there so bad that they'll kill anything or do anything to harm us, what does it say about us if we act the same way back to them? It means that we've succumbed to some attitude about evilness. He said it so eloquently, but it was you know, very moving to hear this guy speak. I mean, you think, well, why did you go in the first place? Of course, there's lots of reasons people go in. I think he believed in it. Not the war, but his service to his country. So he retired after 12 years in the Marine Corps. He's now in graduate school, and he's writing a book. But it's very moving to hear. And he's a jock kind of guy. He's not like a kind of person I would think of would be emotionally sensitive. But he was thinking all these things. As I said, a lot of people I work with are retired. So the whole consciousness about working or being working class, or one of the movements around here is the vortex resistors, which in a lot of ways I admire. Don't give money to the government and then they can't spend it. But if you have a job where your taxes are taken out of your pay, it's much more complicated to participate in that. And if you were a family person, you were a person that owned a little piece of property, some home or something, you know, your home can be attached for that. This actually happened locally to two activists in a town not far from here. The anti-war movement is what sort of got me involved with a group of people who were activists, and that part was good. But when it came to the political analysis or the understanding of it, there's sort of two main ways it goes. One is just activism, nothing wrong with that. And the other is being an activist of conscience. The first activism is, it always seems to me like it's somehow connected to white entitlement. Like, we deserve better, why don't we get it? I'm not sure if I'm accurate in that, but that's how it strikes me. And I'm white, but I don't feel like, you know, economically I had some of that attitude. No, it didn't happen that way for me. So I'm not sure, but these anti-war activists and being active with them has brought me to these other political questions. That and the fact that my son is started getting involved in anarchism, and I wanted to, I'm a single parent, I have one child. I didn't want to lose touch with what he was, you know, thinking about. And in a lot of ways, it just appeals to me, this idea of no government, no authority, anti-authoritarian, definitely anti-capitalism. It all appeals to me. I don't find a lot of people to talk about these ideas and theories with here. If I frame it as an anarchist discussion, doesn't always work. But at the same time, people talk about these things. So I think that, sort of a roundabout way, but somehow that anarchism is like deep within us. This idea of resistance is somebody else telling us what to do. And even more so if it gets organized into a formal hierarchy where there's a president or a governor or somebody up who's then going to tell us what to do. It's it's easy to want to resist that. It's more difficult to understand how to organize against that. Where I work, it's not a unionized, I work in a college, I'm a secretary. It's not unionized. I often get the feeling that people, it's a good job, especially in this area, good benefits, so people are glad to be working there. But that already separates, there's already a way that separates those of us who work there from other people in the area who don't work there. We're privileged in a certain way. We don't organize to have a union. We identify, there's a way that the identity with the college is encouraged, so that you always, people end up working more hours than they're really supposed to. Seems crazy to me. But now that I've been reading a little bit more about sort of class struggle stuff, it's helping me respond to this so that I have, you know, some way to talk about it. I can't tell you right now what that is. It's just engaging in discussion about why are you working overtime, or why are you worried about the insurance companies, health insurance companies wanting us to make sure that our bills, that they're not being overcharged, so we're supposed to check our bills. I just had a healthcare crisis, so I'm involved in this. And I said to my friend, well, why would you want to do that? That's the job of the insurance company, to find out if there's any kind of fraud. You know, in my opinion, we shouldn't have to even be paying for this stuff, you know, especially since Congress people don't. And so, yeah, I guess the healthcare situation is the way I see myself getting involved. I'm still involved with the anti-war group, but I think healthcare is because I had this 2 months of having to deal with an injury sustained falling on the ice, and health insurance companies, these systems that are impossible. And not that the providers themselves were bad, but this whole philosophy of paperwork and insurance, and it's just time for it to be over and for it to change. And, you know, that would be good for a lot of workers. I work for a place where I get great benefits, but a lot of people don't. And why should that be? That's not right. There are some immigrant stuff happening in this area, but not a lot. You don't see a lot of issues in this town. But down the road from us, 15 minutes down the road, is Holyoke, Massachusetts, an industrial town that went through deindustrialization in the 80s, and big influx of Spanish-speaking people, mostly from Puerto Rico, but now also from the Dominican Republic, who originally came here mostly as farm laborers. There are tobacco fields and other agricultural enterprises in this area, Connecticut River Valley. Two of the lowest census tracts in the state, with some of the lowest household incomes, most poverty, you know, urban problems. So that's Holyoke, Massachusetts, about 15 minutes down the road. And about another 10 minutes down the road is Springfield, Massachusetts, a city of about 130,000, I think. Terrible disparities in wealth and poverty. A lot of urban problems, large African-American population, large Spanish-speaking population, and they're set against each other in a city that has squandered a lot of money, a lot of corruption in the government. So if there's a way to work on a project that brings, so that Springfield, Holyoke, and Northampton, Amherst, if we could think of this as a more, not an urban area, but as an area, so that there's more interdependence and more, not so much going down to Springfield or Holyoke to help people, but to do solidarity work with people who are doing things down there. For example, at the U.S. Social Forum, the first one we had this year, about 60 of us from this area went down to Atlanta. We went down in vans. It was a 24-hour drive. And some of the people who went down were from Springfield and were from Holyoke. And it was really great. It was a great way to connect with work that's going on down there, so that when we came back, I went down to Holyoke, to Springfield, to an event they were having around Corey reform. It's prison reform. You know, you get out of prison and you've got a record, and so then you can't get a job and you can't get housing. And so there's a move in Massachusetts to change these rules. And this group was working on it. And these two women that I met at the social forum, one's African-American, one's Puerto Rican, they worked together in this group, but they had never been to a conference before. And when I realized that, and they were cool women about my age, I'm a little older, we hung out together. So I learned a lot. They learned a lot. We got to talk about things together, black-brown struggles, prison issues. And then when I came back here, we were able to keep up a correspondence for a while and a relationship that, you know, I have a day job, so it's not always easy to get down there, but I hope to renew when the weather gets nicer. There was something in that experience of connecting with those women and some women in Holyoke who do labor organizing that was great. You know, my life here is pretty calm. It's a nice town. There's not a lot of crime, not a lot of struggle. I live across the street from where I work. Things are kind of smooth. It's an illusion because so many people's lives are not like that. Not that they have to be that way, but to just live in that bubble without sharing some of the struggles other people have it's a lie because most of my life was a struggle, similar to the women I met. Even though I'm white, I just was on welfare. We were homeless when my son was a baby. I don't want to forget that. It's kind of like Kucinich remembering that he and his family spent time living in a station wagon. This is reality. And it's not bad or good, but it's valuable in terms of living, understanding, you know, what it is, sort of what you have to forget, what you have to forget to not talk about that, to not show that. I think it's kind of a challenge working with the anti-war or people who are settled to bring that in some way, to bring it up without it being like, poor me, I'm a victim, but to present it in the sense of this is reality, to speak from that experience, not only how bad it is, not only the sort of social situations that create the stuff. So that's sort of, you know, revolution, change those social things. But there's a transformation, sort of a personal transformation that has to take place as well in terms of understanding what it is. It's not just me because I'm a woman. That's not the only reason I was in these situations. That's a factor. But how to understand it so that there's a way to live as a human being, a sort of humanization that Paulo Freire talks about all the time. That's a theme that I'm interested in.